Good afternoon. I'm Rachel Leah with Salon TV, and I'm here with a very special guest, Khalid Hosseini, author and goodwill ambassador for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. He wrote best-selling novels Kite Runner, A Thousand Splendid Suns, and The Mountains Echoed, and most recently, the new fiction book, Sea Prayer, which is out tomorrow. Khalid, welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so excited to speak with you. So tell me about Sea Prayer. When did you start writing it and why?
So Sea Prayer was inspired by a very famous photograph, that of young Alan Kurdi, who was a young Syrian boy, a refugee whose family attempted to come to Europe by boat, and the boat capsized and his body washed up on a Turkish beach in 2015. In fact, this month is the third anniversary. And that photograph, as a father, just bludgeoned me. And it prickled the conscience of millions of people around the world. And I had been thinking about that photograph, and I was asked to speak at a fundraiser for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. And in a span of about a couple of afternoons, out came this monologue. And I imagined what it would be like to be his father and to watch that photograph and to see a soldier who didn't know Alan or didn't know the sound of his voice lift his body. Mm. And he also lost his son, Ghalib, and his wife, Rihanna, on that same day. So I just try to imagine what he must be going through as a father himself. And so it was the sort of the germ for writing Sea Prayer.
Mm. And Sea Prayer, it's a lot shorter than the other books you've written and illustrated as well. Yeah. Why did you decide to tell the story in this way?
Well, you could really read it in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's almost like a poem. Mm-hmm. But I was asked to speak at this fundraiser, and I was given 5 minutes, and I was asked to read from one of my books, but I didn't really want to. I was really, really sort of captivated by that photograph. And at the time, I was also involved with work with the UNHCR, specifically with Syrian refugees. And so they was in my heart, it was in my mind, and I just kind of see what came forth. And what came forth is this monologue told by a father to his son who's sleeping in his arms on a moonlit beach the night before they're to attempt one of these sea crossings to Europe.
Mm. It was one of those books, I read it several times, you kind of just can return to and find new things and see new things, even its kind of shortness of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
And as you said, it's written in the form of a letter to your son. Mm-hmm. And it kind of brings in this powerlessness of not being able to protect your child. And you really go into what that means as a parent, you know, who are forced to flee their countries, fleeing from violence and often having to embark on really dangerous journeys. Did you speak to your own children about Alan?
My son, who's 17, and my daughter, who's 15, are well versed in my work with the UNHCR. My son has traveled with me to two missions, last year to Uganda, this year to Sicily and Lebanon. But what I really hope that readers of this small book can take from it is to imagine the desperate circumstances that would force a parent to take their children and to cross the sea, knowing how many people have died attempting that very same crossing, to take the people that they love and cherish the most and put them on these unsafe, unseaworthy, crowded boats that are manned by smugglers who have no regard for human life, with absolutely no assurance that you will make it to the other shore. And even in the best case scenario that you do make it, you face a very uncertain future. These are choices that are not made lightly.
Right.
These are choices of desperation. These boats are vessels of desperation. And often the circumstances that corner people into making these choices are nothing less than existential, as in life and death.
Mm. It kind of illuminated for me how little choice there really is, because what is the alternative? To stay and maybe also experience worse violence, or to try to find some form of safety, and how we need to rethink this kind of shame or whatever it is that we place on families who are forced to flee.
I often say, look, if you want to know what a refugee looks like, pick up a mirror. Mm. I mean, refugees are doctors, they're lawyers, they're teachers, they're IT people, they're people who run coffee shops, they're journalists. And they have been forced. This is not a choice that anybody makes. Nobody chooses to be a refugee. Nobody chooses to abandon their home, their community, their friends, their roots, and leave and become a burden on a host nation. This is not a choice that anybody would want for themselves or for their family. But the fact is that refugees are cornered into these choices by persecution, by abuse, by the threat of violence, by existential fear. And the choice to return home for many of them has been taken from them. Every refugee wants to go home. And this is one of the common things that I run into, no matter where I speak to refugees or what country they're from. A Syrian refugee in June told me quite beautifully, he said, look, even heaven is not home. Mm. And so there's a deep desire to return home, but that choice has been taken. And the choice to leave home for refugees is never easy. It's always agonizing, and it's always last resort. Mm. People try to stick it out as long as possible, and only when things appear absolutely untenable do they make the choice to leave.
Mm. And before we got on camera, you were saying that you were a political refugee as well, and this mm-hmm. marks, did you say the 17th?
I've been in this country for 38 years 30, now.
To this day.
This very day, September 17th, my family arrived. And so I came to the U.S. as a refugee. My family was resettled in the United States in 1980. And so I, as somebody who sort of, my circumstances were quite different. Mm-hmm. Millions of Afghan refugees lived in refugee camps and so on. My family was in France when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And so we were resettled from France to the U.S. But I feel a connection with the circumstances of displaced people.
Yeah.
You know, I through watching my parents, who were middle-aged by the time we arrived in the U.S., I know how hard it can be to, you know, leave home and everything you've worked all your life for, and suddenly your entire life can be described as a small rental house and a suitcase full of clothes and a bunch of kids. That's really hard.
And not even just leaving home, but what does it mean to start over?
It takes a lot of work to establish new identities, to adapt to your new circumstances. My father studied law. He was a diplomat. He worked for the foreign ministry. My mother studied Farsi literature. She taught Farsi and history at a high school for girls. In the United States, when we came here as refugees, they had to redefine who they were. My mom became a waitress at Denny's for a while. Eventually, she became a beautician, and she worked at this little hole-in-the-wall salon for almost 2 decades. My dad, for whom I think the idea of being on social welfare was a real blow to his dignity, took on a bunch of jobs, was a driving instructor, and eventually worked with the city of Santa Clara and gave welfare to refugees who were coming to the U.S. So he went on the other side of it.
As you have picked up that torch as well.
Yeah, and so no, when UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, asked me in 2006 to work with them, I leapt at the chance because I had watched millions of my fellow Afghans flee Afghanistan and all the cycles of war and live in squalid refugee camps in Pakistan and Iran. So I had a very personal connection to their plight.
Did some of that, of your own experience or what you've witnessed, kind of influence Sea Prayer?
Not only Sea Prayer, but I think all my other books. Mm-hmm. To be uprooted and to have to start anew, to learn a new culture, a new language, new circumstance, that's a tectonic shift in your life. And so the idea of displacement is very much present in The Kite Runner. Mm-hmm. It's very much there in And the Mountains Echo, Thousand Splendid Suns, and also in this book.
Mm. One of the lines in Sea Prayer that really struck me is you highlight this hostility towards refugees, and you wrote, I've heard it said we are the uninvited, we are the unwelcome. But you also add that if people even knew a fraction of what Syrian refugees or refugees from anywhere experience, a type of violence, type of persecution, they would be kinder. You talked about one of the number one most misunderstood things is that how hard it is to leave home and people don't want to leave home. What's something else that's really misunderstood about the plight of refugees?
Well, look, I am concerned about sort of this tide of anti-refugee sentiment that we're seeing, especially in Europe where I was last week. But I do think that much of it is based on a series of misconceptions and about who refugees are, what they face, what they're fleeing, and even where they are. You know, there's sort of this misconception that refugees are opportunists who are leaving their home and want to invade Western shores to take Western jobs and live in Western luxury. The fact is that less than 1% of refugees are ever resettled. The vast majority of refugees, to the tune of 85%, don't come to the US or Canada or Europe. They live in countries neighboring their own mm-hmm. in the hope that one day they can return home and cross the border back towards their hometown. Right. They live in places, the 85% of refugees live in places like Lebanon, where one out of six people is a Syrian refugee. They live in Uganda, in Pakistan, in Jordan, Iraq, and so on and so forth. And so for them, the choice to return home has been taken from them because they no longer enjoy the protection of their government. They never wanted to be in this circumstance to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think, given the fact that there's sort of prevalent misconceptions about refugees, misunderstandings about who they are, it's so important that for me, as a writer, to keep telling stories of refugees and to keep trying to bring a human dimension to the headlines that mm-hmm. we see.
I've seen you speak about, you know, that often the neighboring countries are the ones who take the most refugees in. And, you know, there are moral and ethical responsibilities as global citizens. Why do you imagine it's so hard for nations to treat refugees, people who are fleeing violence, with compassion, with humanity?
Well, again, when I was in Lebanon and in Sicily this past June and speaking with refugees, my thought was always, I wish that somehow the world could be collected into a small space and to be placed next to me so that they could hear these stories that mm-hmm. I am hearing, because anybody who heard these stories could only walk away with a sense of compassion, empathy, and solidarity with the things that these people have faced. Again, I think a lot of it is not based on ill will per se, but it really is based on a lot of misunderstandings and lack of information, mm-hmm. and also a disconnect between headlines and actual human stories. Mm. You know, you hear that there have been in 2018 so far at least 10 incidents where 50 or more people died at sea trying to reach Europe. But that's a number. You know, statistics and figures have a way of blunting our emotional response to these stories, and that's why it's important to remind people that every single individual who boarded one of those boats is a human being that is an expression of creation and that is deserving of mm-hmm. being treated with compassion and dignity and have their human rights respected as you are or I am. Mm.
It's interesting then also to have the illustrative aspect of sea prayer, because it's not only verbalizing this humanity but also depicting it in a very, very visual way too.
Yeah, I mean, I owe an enormous debt of gratitude to Dan Williams, who illustrated this book evocatively, gorgeously, I might say. His light touch, his mm-hmm. spot-on choices, his beautiful sensibility have really become the images are such a beautiful partner to the words, and they really enhance each other and has really helped elevate this book, I think, to a very kind of very fulfilling emotional level into a small book that mm-hmm. has a big message
yeah.
and a big heart.
Do you think you would kind of go down this route in the future more?
It was really fun. I enjoyed working with Dan, although I more or less gave him free rein, as it mm-hmm. were. You know, he's a very well-respected artist, and I really enjoyed the process. I never really set out to do an illustrated book. A series of happy accidents happened that culminated in the writing of Sea Prayer, but I really enjoyed the process. Mm.
And besides just writing the book, all the proceeds are going to the UN Refugee Agency and your foundation, correct?
Yes, so I'm donating all my proceeds from the sales of this book to the UNHCR and to the Khaled Hosseini Foundation, which I founded back in 2008 with my wife, and with which we hope to make a difference in the lives of women and children in Afghanistan.
What do you imagine the funds will be used for?
Look, I've been to many regions of the world, and I have seen humanitarian organizations on the ground and the work that they do in providing shelter, education, healthcare, indispensable services that all human beings need and deserve. And the fact is that every single year UNHCR is asking for funds because they're always low on funds. Mm-hmm. And those services are so indispensable and make such an enormous difference in the lives of people who are fleeing war and persecution, that we need to continue to advocate for them and ask for people to donate.
Mm. So this is helping.
Supporting this book will not only hopefully will people read the story and enjoy the story, but also help support a great cause.
Mm. And now, as far as your writing, I was interested to know that you were a doctor first. How did you find writing? It almost seems like two disparate kind of experiences.
There really are. I mean, I never had to find writing. Writing really found me. I hope that doesn't sound too precious, because from the time that I was a small boy, I was deeply attracted to the creative process. I remember storytelling was something that was part of my life for as long as I can remember. When I was a young boy in Afghanistan, I would write little plays for my cousins and siblings, or we would act them out at parties for parents and guests. Mm. And I wrote a lot of short stories when I was a young boy, and I kept writing throughout my life. It was really something that it was a compulsion for myself. It was something that I really, really loved doing. So I never really planned to have a writing career. In fact, I didn't think that was even an option for me. I came to the U.S. I didn't even speak English. And like the children of a lot of immigrants and refugee families, I essentially, my choices were boiled down
right.
to the holy triad, lawyer, doctor, engineer.
Yeah.
So I went to medicine, which I enjoyed, but writing was always my passion.
Mm. And from my stance, your books for me seem rooted in pain and humanity and kind of how universal those topics are. I don't know if you'd agree.
Well, I think they are, first and foremost, they're family stories. You know, all of my books can be described as family stories within which there's so much ground that you can plumb for the great themes of literature.
Mm-hmm.
And this is almost trite to say, but love and loyalty and mm-hmm. friendship and guilt and duty, forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So my books do deal with different circumstances because, you know, they're set in Afghanistan. It's a country that's seen so much turmoil. But what I love about reading is that I can pick up a book about the lost boys of Sudan, which is the farthest thing from my personal experience, and then read that novel and suddenly be in the shoes of somebody who's so different from me. That's the gift of stories, is that they allow us to connect with people that are very different from us. They allow us to widen our moral imagination. And that's why I think, again, one of my real hopes for this book, in whatever capacity, is that we'll help humanize headlines mm-hmm. and numbers and remind people that there are actual human beings behind these stories that we hear about in the news.
Right, I almost see your books as windows, you know, into the Middle East or Afghanistan specifically. But as I was saying before, how important and vital it is in depicting people from that region with humanity, with interiority, you know. And so I think that's really special. And, you know, your book, Kite Runner, has been, translated into 40-plus languages at this point, adapted for screen, you know, clearly beloved all over the world. And, you know, people can read and get windows inside. Is that significant to you, that your books, you know, are read all over the world and translated into many, many languages?
Well, I mean, it's enormously gratifying for me as an individual, as a writer, certainly, to know that I can connect with somebody who lives in Yemen mm-hmm. or Johannesburg. And it also speaks to the power of stories. We are a species hardwired to respond to story, to narrative, to meaning. We intellectually get facts, and we get numbers and statistics and figures and the things that hard news can provide. But for us to really understand something, to really care about something, ultimately we need to be invited into some kind of human experience, some kind of storytelling process by which we recognize a piece of ourselves in somebody else's life. And I think that's what, it's not unique to Kite Runner. I think any novel that people have enjoyed, they see themselves in these stories. You know, in the Kite Runner, maybe a young boy will see his father, or will see somebody who didn't stand up for his friend. A refugee might see that experience of being displaced, and so on and so forth. Everybody brings their own experience to the reading of a book.
Mm. I think especially in this time, whether we're talking about stories being told in Hollywood or TV or books, you know, there's a need, and we're understanding the importance of hearing stories from all over the world, from people from all walks of life, because there have been for so long only some stories that are represented fully, and that experience is kind of, you know, understood, but a lot of other experiences have been marginalized in the world and in literature and TV. And so this, as you said, it helps put a face to something that's affecting millions and millions of people.
Yeah, no, and look, in the span of time that you and I have been speaking, a lot of people have become displaced. A person is forcibly displaced every 2 seconds. I mean, there are over 68 million people in the world displaced, over 25 million refugees. This is a displacement crisis of historic proportions. And so I feel it's, and we are dealing with a climate that is not always friendly to the plight of refugees. And so I feel that telling the stories of refugees, inviting readers to re-engage with this issue, perhaps even on a personal level, to share these stories with their friends, their community, their families, is vital.
Mm. And See Prayer, it's out tomorrow. Everyone can buy it where they buy
told.
Books.
Yes.
Wonderful. Congratulations on the new book, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate